Cassette 18, side 2.
We have acted as we had to act. So true, so true. She loved the truth of these things. Sad plays, sad music, threnodies, gypsy tangos, Prometheus bound, even the Jacobean revenge plays, the darker the better, really. The truer. She did the lighting for Titus Andronicus, and people were disgusted, appalled. They said it was just a bloodbath, and by God, she certainly used a lot of red spots. But that moment when the handless and tongueless Lavinia tried to indicate who had done it to her, or knelt to carry away Titus's severed hand in her teeth like a dog, the audience had been as if frozen. One couldn't say that Shakespeare hadn't had his sense of stagecraft right from the start, bloodbath or no. And then with every play he had gotten more powerful, more electrifyingly dark and true, even as an old man. She had come out of a long, harrowing, inspired performance of King Lear in an elation, flushed and laughing, grabbing a young member of the lighting crew by the shoulder, shaking him, shouting, "Was that not wonderful, magnificent?" "Ka, Maya, I don't know. I might have preferred the restoration version myself. The one where Cordelia is saved and marries Edgar. Do you know that one?" "Bah, stupid child. We have told the truth tonight. That is what is important. You can go back to your lies in the morning." Laughing harshly at him and throwing him back to his friends, "Foolish youth!" He explained to the friends, "It's Maya."
"Toitovna? The one in the opera?"
"Yes, but for real."
"Real?"
Maya scoffed, waving them away. "You don't even know what real is." And she felt that she did. And friends came to town, visiting for a week or two. And then, as the summers got warmer and warmer, they took to spending one of the Decembers out in a beach village west of the town, in a shack behind the dunes, swimming and sailing and windsurfing and lying on the sand under an umbrella, reading and sleeping through the perihelion. Then back into Odessa, to the familiar comforts of their apartment and the town, in the burnished light of the southern autumn, which was the longest season of the Martian year, also the approach to aphelion, day after day dimmer and dimmer, until aphelion came on LS-70, and between then and the winter solstice at LS-90 was the ice festival, and they ice skated on the white sea ice right under the Cornish, looking up at the town's seafront all drifted with snow, white under black clouds, or ice boating so far out on the ice that the town was just a break in the white curve of the big rim, or eating by herself in steamy, loud restaurants, waiting for the music to start, wet snow pelting down on the street outside, walking into a musty little theater and its anticipatory laughter, eating out on the balcony for the first time in the spring, sweater on against the chill, looking at the new buds on the tips of the tree twigs, a green unlike any other, like little Veriditas teardrops. And so around, deep in the folds of habit and its rhythms, happy in the deja vu that one made for oneself. Then she turned on her screen one morning and checked the news and found out that a large settlement of Chinese had been discovered already ensconced in Huosing Vallis, as if the name justified the intrusion. A surprised global police had ordered them to leave, but now they were calmly defying the order. And the Chinese government was warning Mars that any interference with the settlement would be regarded as an attack on Chinese citizens with an appropriate response.
"What?"
Maya shouted.
"No!"
She called up everyone in Mangala she knew. These days, there weren't that many of them in positions of any importance. She asked what they knew and demanded to be told why the settlers weren't being escorted back to the elevator and sent home and so on.
"This is simply not acceptable. You have to stop it now."
But incursions only a bit less blatant had been happening for some time now, as she had seen herself in occasional news reports. Immigrants were being landed in cheap landing vehicles, bypassing the elevator and the authorities in Sheffield. Rocket and parachute landings, as in the old days. And there was little that could be done about it without provoking an interplanetary incident. People were working hard on the problem behind the scenes. The UN was backing China, so it was hard. Progress was being made, slowly but surely. She was not to worry. She shut down the screen. Once upon a time, she had suffered under the illusion that if only she exerted herself hard enough, the whole world would change. Now she knew better, although it was a hard thing to admit.
"It's enough to turn you red," she said to Michelle as she left for work. "It's enough to get us up to Mangala," she warned him.
But in a week, the crisis passed. An accommodation was reached. The settlement was allowed to remain, and the Chinese promised to send up a correspondingly smaller number of legal immigrants the following year. Very unsatisfactory, but there it was. Life went on under this new shadow. Except she was walking home one late spring afternoon after work, and a line of rose bushes at the back of the Cornish caught her attention, and she walked over to have a closer look. Behind the bushes, people were walking on Harmakis Avenue by the cafes, most of them in a hurry. The bushes had a lot of new leaves, their brown a mixture of green and red. The new roses were a pure dark red, their lustrous velvet petals glowing in the afternoon light. "Lincoln," the tag on the trunk said. A kind of rose. Also the greatest American, a man who had been a kind of combination of John and Frank, as Maya understood him. One of the group had written a great play about him, dark and troubling, the hero murdered senselessly, a real heartbreaker. They needed a Lincoln these days. The red of the roses was glowing brightly. Suddenly she couldn't see. For a moment everything dazzled, as if she had glanced into the sun. Then she was looking at an array of things, shapes, colors. She was aware of that much, but what they were, who she was, wordlessly she struggled to recognize. Then it all crashed back at once. Rose, Odessa, all of it, just as if it had never been gone. But she staggered. She had to catch her balance. "Ah, no," she said. "My God." She swallowed. Throat dry, very dry, a physiological event. It had lasted quite some time. She hissed, choked back a cry, stood rigid on the gravel path, the hedge brown-green before her, spotted by livid red. She would have to remember that color effect for the next Jacobean play they did. She had always known it was going to happen. She had always known. Habit. Such a liar. She knew that. Inside her ticked a bomb. In the old days, it had had 3 billion ticks, more or less. Now they had rigged it to have 10 billion or more, or less. The ticks kept ticking, nevertheless. She had heard of a clock one could buy, which ran downward through a certain finite number of hours, presumably those you had left if you were to live to 500 years, or whatever length of life you chose. Choose 1 million and relax. Choose 1 and pay a little bit closer attention to the moment. Or dive into your habits and never think about it like everyone else she knew. She would have been perfectly happy to do that. She had done it before and would do it again. But now in this moment something had happened, and she was back in the interregnum, the stripped time between sets of habits, waiting for the next exfoliation. No, no! Why? She didn't want such a time. They were too hard. She could scarcely stand the raw sense of time passing that came to her during these periods, the sense that everything was for the last time. She hated that feeling, hated it. And this time she hadn't changed her habits at all. Nothing was different. It had struck out of the blue. Maybe it had been too long since the last time, habits notwithstanding. Maybe it would start happening now whenever it chose to, randomly, perhaps frequently. She went home, thinking, "I know where my home is," and tried to tell Michelle what had happened, describing and sobbing and describing, and then giving up. "We only do things once. Do you understand?" He was very concerned, though he tried not to show it. Blank outs or not, she had no trouble recognizing the moods of Monsieur Duval. He said that her little jamais vu was perhaps a small epileptic fit or a tiny stroke, but he couldn't be sure, and even tests might not tell them. Jamais vu was poorly understood, a variation on déjà vu, essentially its reverse. It seems to be a kind of temporary interference in the brain's wave patterns. They go from alpha waves to delta waves in a little dip. If you'll wear a monitor, we could find out next time it happens, if it does. It's somewhat like a waking sleep in which a lot of cognition shuts down. Do people ever get stuck there? No, I don't know of any cases like that. It's rare and always temporary. So far. He tried to act as if that were a baseless fear. Maya knew better and went into the kitchen to start a meal. Bang the pots, open the refrigerator, pull out vegetables, chop them and throw them in the pan. Chop, 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 chop. Stop to cry, stop to stop crying. Even this had happened 10,000 times before. The disasters one couldn't avoid, the habit of hunger. In the kitchen, trying to ignore everything and make a meal. How many times? Well, here we are. After that, she avoided the row of rose bushes, fearful of another incident. But of course, they were visible from anywhere on that stretch of the Corniche, right out to the seawall. And they were in bloom almost all the time. Roses were amazing that way. And once in that same afternoon light, pouring over the Hellespontus and making everything to the west somewhat washed out, darkened to pastel opacities, her eye caught the pinprick reds of the roses in the hedge, even though she was walking the seawall, and seeing the tapestry of foam on the black water to one side of her, and the roses and Odessa rising up to the other side, she stopped, stilled by something in the double vision, by a realization, or almost, the edge of an epiphany, she felt some vast truth pushing at her just outside her, or inside her body, even inside her skull, but outside her thoughts, pushing at the dura which encased the brain. Everything explained, everything come clear at last, for once. But the epiphany never made it through the barrier. A feeling only, cloudy and huge. Then the pressure on her mind passed, and the afternoon took on its ordinary pewter luminance. She walked home feeling full, oceans of clouds in her chest, full to bursting with something like frustration or a kind of anguished joy. Again she told Michel what had happened, and he nodded. He had a name for this, too. Presque-vu. Almost seen. I get that one a lot, he said, with a characteristic look of secret sorrow. But all of his symptomatic categories suddenly seemed to Maya only to mask what was really happening to her. Sometimes she got very confused. Sometimes she thought she understood things that didn't exist. Sometimes she forgot things forever. And sometimes she got very, very scared. And these were the things Michel was trying to contain with his names and his combinatoires. Almost seen. Almost understood. And then back into the world of light and time, and there was nothing for it but to go on. And so on she went. Enough days passed, and she could forget what it had felt like, forget just how frightened she had been. Or how close to joy. It was a strange enough thing that it was easy to forget. Just live in la vie quotidienne. Pay attention to daily life with its work, friends, visitors. Among other visitors were Charlotte and Ariadne, who came down from Mangala to consult with Maya about the worsening situation with Earth. They went out to breakfast on the Corniche and talked about Dorsa Brevia's concerns. Essentially, despite the fact that the Minoans had left the Free Mars Coalition because they disliked its attempt to dominate the outer satellite settlements, Among other things, the Dorsibrevians had come to think Jackie had been right about immigration, at least to an extent. It's not that Mars is approaching its human carrying capacity, Charlotte said. They're wrong about that. We could tighten our belts, densify the towns. And these new floating towns on the North Sea could accommodate a lot of people. They're a sign of how many more could live here. They have practically no impact, except on harbor towns in some senses. But there's room for more harbor towns on the North Sea anyway. Many more, Maya said. Despite the Terran incursions, she didn't like to hear anti-immigrant talk in any form. But Charlotte was back on the Executive Council, and for years she had supported a close relation to Earth, so this was hard for her to say. It isn't the numbers. It's who they are, what they believe. The assimilation troubles are getting really severe. Maya nodded. I've read about them on the screen. Yes, we've tried to integrate newcomers every way we know, but they clump naturally, and you can't just break them up. No. But so many problems arising. Cases of Sharia, family abuse, ethnic gangs getting in fights, immigrants attacking natives, usually men attacking women, but not always. And young native gangs are retaliating, harassing the new settlements and so on. It's big trouble. And this with immigration already much reduced, at least legally. But the UN is angry with us about that. They want to send up even more. And if they do, we'll become a kind of human disposal site, and all our work will have gone to waste. Maya shook her head. She knew the problem, of course. But it was depressing to think that allies like these might leave and join the other side just because the problem was getting hard. Still, whatever you do has to take the UN into account. If you ban immigration, and they immigrate anyway, and back it up, then our work goes to waste even quicker. That's what's been happening with these incursions, right? Better to allow immigration, to keep it at the lowest level that would be satisfactory to the UN, and deal with the immigrants as they come. The two women nodded unhappily. They ate for a while, looking out at the fresh blue of the morning sea. Ariadne said, The ex-Metas are a problem as well. They want to come here even more than the UN. Of course. It was no surprise to Maya that the old Meta-Nationals were still such powers on Earth. Of course they had all aped the Praxis model to survive, and so with that fundamental change in their nature, they were no longer like totalitarian fiefdoms out to conquer the world, but they were still big and strong, with a lot of people in them and a lot of capital accumulated, and they still wanted to do business, to make their members livings. Strategies for doing that were sometimes admirable, sometimes not. One could make things that people really needed in a new and better way, or one could play the angles, try to press advantages, try to inflate false needs. Most ex-Metas pursued a mix of strategies, of course, trying to stabilize by diversification as in their old investment days. But that made fighting the bad strategies even harder in a way, because everyone was pursuing them to some extent. And now a lot of ex-Metas were pursuing very active Martian programs, working for the Terran governments and shipping people up from Earth, building cities and starting farms, mining, production, trade. Sometimes it seemed that emigration from Earth to Mars wouldn't cease until there was an exact balance in their fullnesses, which, given the hyper-Malthusian situation on Earth, would be a disaster for Mars. Yes, yes, Maya said impatiently. Nevertheless, we have to try to help, and we have to keep ourselves within the realm of the acceptable vis-a-vis Earth, or else it will be war. So Charlotte and Ariadne went away, both looking as worried as Maya felt. And it suddenly occurred to Maya, very grimly, that if they were coming to her for help, then they were in deep trouble indeed. So her direct political work picked up again, although she tried to keep a limit on it. She seldom traveled away from Odessa except for AWT business. She didn't stop working with her theater group, which in any case was now the true heart of her political work. But she started going to meetings again and rallies, and sometimes she took the stage and spoke. Werther's Wandel took many forms. One night she even got carried away and agreed to run for Odessa's seat in the Global Senate as a member of the Terran Society of Friends, if they couldn't find a more viable candidate. Later, when she had a chance to think it over, she begged them to look for someone else first, and in the end they decided to go with one of the young playwrights from the group who worked in the Odessa town administration, a good choice. So she escaped that and went on doing what she could to help the Earth Quakers less actively, feeling more and more odd about it, for one couldn't overshoot a planet's carrying capacity without disaster following. That was what Earth's history since the 19th century existed to prove. So they had to be careful, and not let too many people up. It was a tightrope act, but coping with a limited period of overpopulation was better than dealing with an outright invasion, and this was a point she made in meeting after meeting. And all this time, Nergal was out there in the outback, wandering in his nomadic life and talking to the ferals and the farmers, and, she hoped, having his usual effect on the Martian worldview, on what Michel called its collective unconscious. She pinned a lot of her hopes on Nergal, and did her best to deal with this other strand in her life, to face up to history, in some ways the darkest strand of all, as it stitched its course through her life and bunched it up, in a big twisting loop, back into the foreboding that had prevailed during her previous life in Odessa. So that was already a kind of malign déjà vu. And then the real déjà vus came back, sucking the life out of things as they always did. Oh, a single flash of the sensation was just a jolt, of course, a fearful reminder, here then gone, but a day of it was torture, and a week, hell itself. The stereotemporal state, Michel said the current medical journals were calling it. Others called it the always-already sensation. Apparently a problem for a certain percentage of the ancient ones, and nothing could be worse in terms of her emotions. She would wake on these days, and every moment of the day would be an exact repetition of some earlier identical day. This was how it felt, as if Nietzsche's notion of the eternal recurrence, the endless repetition of all possible space-time continuums, had become somehow transparent for her, a lived experience. Horrible, horrible! And yet there was nothing to do but stagger through the always already of the foreseen days, zombie-like, until the curse lifted, sometimes in a slow fog, sometimes in a quick snap back to the non-stereotemporal state, like double vision coming back into focus, giving things back their depth. Back to the real, with its blessed sense of newness, contingency, blind becoming, where she was free to experience each moment with surprise and feel the ordinary rise and fall of her emotional sine wave, a roller coaster which, though uncomfortable, was at least movement. "Ah, good," Michel said as she came out of one of these spells, obviously wondering which of the drugs he had been giving her had done the trick. "Maybe if I could just get to the other side of a presque-vu," Maya said weakly. "Not déjà or presque or jamais, but just the vu." A kind of enlightenment, Michel guessed. Satori, or epiphany, a mystical oneness with the universe. It's usually a short-lived phenomenon, I am told, a peak experience. "But with a residue?" "Yes. Afterward, you feel better about things, but, well, it's said to usually come only if one achieves a certain serenity? No, well, yes. Stillness of mind, you might say. Not my kind of thing, you mean?" Which cracked a grin. "But it could be cultivated. Prepared for, I mean. That's what they do in Zen Buddhism, if I understand it correctly." So she read some Zen texts, but they all made it clear. Zen wasn't information, but behavior. If your behavior was right, then the mystic clarity might descend, or might not. And even if it did, it was usually a brief thing, a vision. She was too stuck in her habits for that kind of change in her mental behavior. She wasn't in the kind of control of her thoughts that could prepare for a peak experience. She lived her life, and these mental breakdowns intruded on her. Thinking about the past helped to trigger them, it seemed, so she focused on the present as much as she could. That was Zen, after all, and she got fairly good at it. It had been an instinctive survival strategy for years, but a peak experience. Sometimes she yearned for it, for the almost seen to be seen at last. A presque-vu would descend on her. The world take on that aura of vague, powerful meaning just outside her thoughts, and she would stand and push, or relax, or just try to follow it to bring it on home. Curious, fearful, hoping. And then it would fade and pass. Still, someday, if only it would come clear, it might help in the time after. And sometimes she was so curious. What would the insight be? What was that understanding which hovered just outside her mind those times? It felt too real to be just an illusion. So, though it didn't occur to her at first that this was what she was seeking, she accepted an invitation from Nergal to go with him to the Olympus Mons Festival. Michelle thought it was a great idea. Once every M-year in the northern spring, people met on the summit of Olympus Mons near Crater ZP to hold a festival inside a cascade of crescent-shaped tents over stone and tile mosaics, as during that first meeting there, the celebration of the end of the great storm when the ice asteroid had blazed across the sky and John had spoken to them of the coming Martian society. Which society, Maya thought as they ascended the great volcano in a train car, might be said to have arrived, at least in certain times and places. Now, here. Here we are. On Olympus, on LS-90 every year, to remember John's promise and celebrate its achievement. By far, the greater number of celebrants were young natives, but there were a lot of new immigrants as well, come up to see what the famous festival was like, intent on partying all week long, mostly by continuously playing music or dancing to it, or both. Maya preferred dance, as she still played no other instrument than the tambourine, and she lost Michelle and all their other friends there, Nadia and Art and Sax and Marina and Ursula and Mary and Nergal and Diana and all the rest, so that she could dance with strangers and forget. Do nothing but focus on the passing faces luminous before her, each one like a pulsar of consciousness, crying, "I'm alive, I'm alive, I'm alive!" Great dancing all night long. A sign that assimilation might be happening, the Areophany working its invisible spell on everyone who came to the planet so that their toxic Terran pasts would be diluted and forgotten, and the true Martian culture achieved at last in a collective creation. Yes, and fine. But no peak experience. This was not the place for it. Not for her. It was too much the dead hand of the past, perhaps. Things were pretty much the same on the peak of Olympus Mons, the sky still black and starry with a purple band around the horizon. There were hostels built around the immense rim, Marina said, for pilgrims to stay in as they made circumnavigations of the summit, and other shelters down in the caldera for the red climbers who spent their existence down in that world of overlapping convex cliffs. Strange what people would do, Maya thought. Strange what destinies were being enacted on Mars nowadays. But not by her. Olympus Mons was too high, therefore too stuck in the past. It wasn't where she was going to have the kind of experience she was seeking. She did, however, get a chance to have a long talk with Nergal on the train ride back to Odessa. She told him about Charlotte and Ariadne and their concerns, and he nodded and told her about some of his adventures in the outback, many illustrating progress in assimilation. "We'll win in the end," he predicted. "Mars right now is the battleground of past and future, and the past has its power, but the future is where we're all going. There's a kind of inexorable power in it, like a vacuum pull forward. These days I can almost feel it. and he looked happy. Then he pulled their bags off the overhead racks. He kissed her cheek. He was thin and hard, slipping away from her. "We'll keep working on it, yes? I'll come visit you and Michelle in Odessa. I love you." Which made her feel better, of course. No peak experience, but a train trip with Nergal, a chance to talk with that most elusive native, that most beloved son. After her return from the mountain, however, she continued to be subject to her array of mental events, as Michelle called them. He got more worried every time one of them happened. They were beginning to scare him, Maya saw, even though he tried to hide it. And no wonder. These events, and others like them, were happening to a lot of his aged clients. The gerontological treatments couldn't seem to help people's memories hold onto their ever-lengthening pasts, and as their pasts slipped away year by year, and their memories weakened, the incidence of events grew ever higher until some people even had to be institutionalized. Or alternatively, they died. The first settlers' institute that Michelle continued to work with had a smaller group of subjects every year. Even Vlad died one year. After that, Marina and Ursula moved from Acheron to Odessa. Nadia and Art had already moved to West Odessa after their daughter Nikki had grown up and moved there. Even Sax Russell took an apartment in town, though he spent most of the year in Da Vinci still. For Maya, these moves were both good and bad. Good because she loved all these people, and it felt like they were clustering around her, which pleased her vanity. And it was a great pleasure to see their faces. So she helped Marina, for instance, to help Ursula to deal with Vlad's loss. It seemed that Ursula and Vlad had been the true couple, in some sense, though Marina and Ursula, well, there were no terms for the 3 points of a ménage à trois, no matter how it was constituted. Anyway, Marina and Ursula were now the remainder, a couple very close in their grieving, otherwise much like the young native same-sex couples one saw in Odessa, men arm in arm on the street, a comforting sight, women hand in hand. So she was happy to see the two of them, or Nadia, or any of the rest of the old gang. But she couldn't always remember the incidents they discussed as if unforgettable, and this was irritating. Another kind of jamais vu, her own life. No, it was better to focus on the moment, to go down and work on water, or the lighting for the current play, or sit chatting in the bars with new friends from work, or with complete strangers, waiting for that enlightenment to someday come. Samantha died, then Boris. Oh, there were 2 or 3 years between their deaths, but still, after the long decades during which none of them had died, this frequency pattern felt very fast. So they got through those funerals as best they could, and meanwhile everything was getting darker, as on the Cornish when a black squall approached from over the Hellespontus. Terran nations still sending up unauthorized people and landing them, the UN still threatening, China and Indonesia suddenly at each other's throats, red echoteurs blowing things up more and more indiscriminately, recklessly killing people. And then Michelle came up the stairs, heavy with grief. Yelly died.
What? No. Oh, no.
Some kind of heart arrhythmia.
Oh, my God.
Maya hadn't seen Yelly for decades, but to lose another one of the remaining first 100, lose the possibility of ever seeing again Yelly's shy smile.
No.
She didn't hear the rest of what Michelle said, not so much from grief as from distraction, or grief for herself.
This is going to happen more and more often, isn't it? She said at last,
when she noticed Michelle staring at her. He sighed.
Maybe.
Again, most of the surviving members of the first 100 came to Odessa for the memorial service organized by Michelle. Maya learned a lot about Yelly in those calls, mostly from Nadia. He had left Underhill and moved to Laswitz early on. He had helped to build the dome town and had become an expert in aquifer hydrology.
In 61, he had wandered with Nadia, trying to repair structures and stay out of trouble, but in Cairo, where Maya had seen him briefly, he had gotten separated from the others and missed the escape down Marineris. At the time, they had assumed he had been killed like Sasha, but in fact he had survived, as most of the people in Cairo had, and after the revolt he had moved down to Saba Shi'i and worked again in aquifers, linking up with the underground and helping to make Saba Shi'i into the capital of the demi-monde. He had lived for a while with Mary Dunkel, and when Saba Shi'i was closed down by Anta, he and Mary had come through Odessa. They had been there for the M50 celebration, which was the last time Maya remembered seeing him, all the Russians in the group offering up the old drinking toasts. Then he and Mary broke up, Mary said, and he moved to Senzeni-Na and became one of the leaders there in the Second Revolution. When Senzeni-Na joined Nicosia and Sheffield in Cairo in the East Tharsis Alliance, he had gone up to help in the Sheffield situation. After that, he had returned to Senzeni-Na, served on its first independent town council, and slowly become one of the grandfathers of the community there, just like so many others of the First Hundred had elsewhere. He had married a Nigerian Nisei. They had had a boy. He had been back to Moscow twice and was a popular commentator on Russian vids. Right before his death, he had been working on the Arjar Basin project with Peter, siphoning off some big aquifers under the Karita Montes without disturbing the surface. A great-granddaughter living out on Callisto was pregnant. But then one day during a picnic on the Senzeni-Na Moho Mound, he had collapsed, and they hadn't been able to revive him. So they were down to the first 18. Although Sachs, of all people, made a provisional inclusion of 7 more for the possibility that Hiroko's band was still alive somewhere. Maya regarded this as a fantasy, obvious wishful thinking. But on the other hand, Sachs wasn't prone to wishful thinking, so maybe there was something to it. Only 18 for certain, however, and the youngest of them, Mary, unless Hiroko were alive, was now 212 years old. The oldest, Anne, was 226. Maya herself was 221, an obvious absurdity, but there it was, year 2206 in the Terran news reports. But there are people in their 250s, Michel noted, and the treatments may very well continue to work for a long, long time. This may just be a bad coincidence.
Maybe.
Each death seemed to cut a piece from him. He was getting darker and darker, which irritated Maya. No doubt he still thought he should have stayed in Provence. That was his wish-fulfillment fantasy. This imaginary home that persisted in the face of the obvious fact that Mars was his home, and had been from the moment they had landed, or from the moment he had joined Hiroko, or perhaps from the moment he had first seen it in the sky as a boy. No one could say when it had happened, but Mars was his home, and it was obvious to everyone but him. And yet he pined for Provence, and considered Maya both his exiler and his country in exile. Her body, his replacement, Provence. Her breasts, his hills. Her belly, his valley. Her sex, his beach and ocean. Of course, it was an impossible project being someone's home as well as their partner, but as it was all nostalgia anyway, and as Michel believed in impossible projects as good things, it generally turned out all right. Part of their relationship, though sometimes an awful burden for her. And never more than when a death of one of the First Hundred drove him to her, and thus to thoughts of home. Sachs was always vexed at a funeral or memorial service. Clearly he felt that death was some kind of rude imposition, a flagrant bit of the great unexplainable waving its red flag in his face. He couldn't abide it. It was a scientific problem waiting to be solved. But even he was baffled by the various manifestations of the quick decline, which were always different except for the speed of their effect and the lack of an obvious single cause. A wave collapse like her jamais vu, a kind of jamais vive. Theories were endless. It was a vital concern for all the old ones.
and all the younger ones who expected to become old. For everyone, in other words. And so it was being intensely studied. But so far, no one knew for sure what the quick decline was, or even if it was any one thing. And the death kept happening. For Yelly's service, they cast some portion of his ashes off in another swiftly rising balloon, launching it from the same point of the breakwater they had launched Spencer, standing out where they could look back and see all Odessa. Afterward, they retreated to Maya and Michelle's apartment. Praxis indeed, the way they held each other then. They went through Michelle's scrapbooks, talking about Olympus Mons, 61, Underhill, the past. Maya ignored all that and served them tea and cakes, until only Michelle and Sax and Nadia remained in the apartment. The wake was over. She could relax. She stopped at the kitchen table, put her hand on Michelle's shoulder, and looked over it at a grainy, black-and-white photo, stained by what looked like spots of spaghetti sauce and coffee. A faded picture of a young man grinning right at the camera, grinning with a confident, knowing smile.
"What an interesting face," she said.